My name's Sue King, and I'm the MC for this Don Dunstan Foundation Oxfam Human Rights Oration, the second for 2012. In opening, we acknowledge that we are meeting on the traditional country of the Kaurna people of the Adelaide Plains. We recognise and respect their cultural heritage, beliefs, and relationship with the land. We acknowledge that they're of continuing importance to the Kaurna people living today, and we pay our respects to their elders. The Don Dunstan Human Rights Orations have grown out of a partnership between the late Don Dunstan and the then Australian NGO Community Aid Abroad, now, as we all know, Oxfam Australia. Late in 2002, the Dunstan Foundation approached Oxfam Community Aid Abroad to make the idea of an Adelaide Human Rights Oration a reality, and thus was born these Don Dunstan Human Rights Orations. Each year, these orations have attracted significant interest in the Adelaide community. However, this year, the Don Dunstan Foundation and Oxfam have broken new ground by bringing us this, a second human rights oration. To open the oration proceedings, I call on the Honourable Robert Hill, Chancellor of the University of Adelaide.
Well, thank you. And to our orator, welcome. And former Justice Kirby, particularly welcome also. And to all of you, welcome. That's my job, to welcome you on behalf of the University of Adelaide, not only because we appreciate our joint role with Flinders in relation to the foundation, but also because you're on University of Adelaide land. But I was asked if I would say something else, and that is just a few words on my family's connection to the subject matter of tonight's oration. Now, I'm normally a bit uncomfortable in doing that sort of thing, but I said yes because I am. My family are very proud of my father's role in this subject matter, and a few of his old colleagues are here. I see in the front row tonight is from the Legislative Council of those days in the 1970s. But he, of course, introduced the bill on the 26th of July 1972 to decriminalise homosexuality, and it was the first time that such a bill had been introduced in South Australia. And as we were the first state to ultimately decriminalise homosexuality, I presume it was the first such bill to be introduced in Australia. He wasn't the first to write such a bill. That, as I understand, was Don Dunstan himself, who wrote that bill in the mid-1960s, when he was then Attorney General in the Walsh government, and he got cabinet support to introduce the bill, but he couldn't get caucus support to do so. And when you, if you ever come to read the debate of July 1972, you will have some sense of why he didn't get caucus support. This was not a party political issue. In fact, my father's bill was a free vote on both sides of the aisle, as the Americans say. And those for and against had no relationship to the political parties. Parties at all. I'm pleased that I played just a very small role in all of that, because I was a young lawyer who'd either just left the Crown Law Department or was just about to leave, and my father asked me if I'd give him a hand in the drafting of this bill. I've never said this publicly before, but anyway, a mate of mine from the Crown Law Department and I one night sat down in my family home, and we put the final touches, the final language together on that bill. So we had our little bit of sense of ownership of the project. Why would someone who in many ways was a conservative, such as my father, do so? And I think it is a civil liberties issue, but there's no doubt that the terrible circumstances of Dr. Duncan's death caused certain individuals within the parliament, no matter where they sat, to feel that there was something they had to do. They may have always thought that perhaps that legislation needed to be changed, but that tragic event, I think, galvanised them into thinking they should take this action. And it wasn't easy action. I can remember that my father copped a lot of abuse for introducing that bill. But anyway, the debate ensued, and it wasn't a very pretty debate. There was a lot of prejudice and a lot of bitterness, a lot of anger, and I think our orator will make the point that we have made progress, and I think today, and even though you may well think there's a lot that still needs to be done, when you go back and read the attitudes of that time, which is not really very long ago, you'll actually, I think, appreciate that we have made progress. Anyway, the bill lost in the end because Ren de Garis, who some of you also know, a very canny politician, found the manoeuvre to, in effect, defeat the bill, although to do it in a way that looked as if it wasn't, you know, something was given. So Ren de Garis moved the amendment which changed the content so that it became a defence. So it didn't decriminalise, but it became a defence if you could show that it was with consent and over 21 and so forth. So, and I can remember we were pretty cranky about that because we felt that we'd lost. And losing to Ren de Garis made you particularly cranky, as some here would understand. I think my father got his ultimate revenge in relation to the franchise in the upper house, the land franchise, over Ren. So Ren didn't win every time, but on that one he did, and he took the majority with him. But even though it didn't achieve all that it was intended to, I think it did add to the momentum, which ultimately led to Peter Duncan's bill 3 years later in 1975 under the Dunstan leadership, which did lead to the decriminalisation and did become the first state for South Australia, to become the first state of Australia to do it. So that's my little bit of family history and why this oration tonight is particularly special to me. And I'm looking forward to it, and thank you all for attending.
Thank you, Chancellor, both for your welcome to the university, but also for that lovely bit of South Australian history that you shared. It's now my pleasure to call on Ms. Anne Gale, our newly appointed Equal Opportunity Commissioner, who will introduce Professor Altman. But in doing so, I would like to congratulate Anne on her very recent appointment and welcome you. I hope that we'll see a lot more of you.
Good evening, and thank you for this opportunity to introduce Professor Dennis Altman tonight. After just a few weeks in my role as Equal Opportunity Commissioner here in South Australia, it is a true honour and a privilege to introduce him. Professor Dennis Altman is a Professor of Politics and Director at the Institute for Human Security at La Trobe University. He is also a well-known commentator in the Australian media. His first major piece of work, Homosexual Oppression and Liberation, was published in 1972, following his time living in New York in 1970-71. In this work, he combined his account of personal experiences with an analysis of the gay liberation movement at the time. Reviews of this book, as many of you would know, have hailed it as the first serious analysis of the gay liberation movement in recognition of its depth of analysis and the theoretical structure it gave to the voices of the emerging movement. He drew on the existing writings and positions, acknowledging the various viewpoints as healthy diversity. This book also proposed that sexuality should not be placed in neat categories. Diversity is key and sexuality is fluid. The following decade, and you just heard about some of that during the 70s, from the Honourable Robert Hill, saw the breakdown of some of the most significant barriers to the acceptance of homosexuality in Western society. And the example given to you was one I was going to draw on, and I don't need to. And as you know, during that period and the debate that Robert has referred to, South Australia became the first Australian state to fully decriminalise homosexuality. Professor Altman's book resonated with gay communities across the Western world and has been published in many countries. Most recently, it was published in Japan in 2010, a recognition of its ongoing relevance and that societies across the world continue to value it as a reference. In his academic career, Professor Altman has written 11 books, well, a further 11 books, and has written many journal articles, book chapters, and delivered many speeches. His major fields of expertise are sexuality and politics and their interrelationship in Australia, the United States, and internationally. His book Global Sex was printed in 5 languages. It examined the globalisation of sexuality, how issues related to sexuality, gender, political power, and public health are treated in the globalised world. In 2000, he was elected a Fellow of the Academy of Social Sciences in Australia. In his community life, Professor Altman has served in leadership roles in international AIDS organisations. He has served on the board of Oxfam, and in 2008, he was made a member of the Order of Australia for his services to education as an academic, social and political commentator, his service to the community through raising awareness of human rights issues, and his contribution to the development of HIV and AIDS policy. While 40 years has passed since 1972, Professor Altman's continued achievements in Australia and internationally continue to demonstrate the ongoing importance and relevance of working towards equality for all and pursuing human rights. At the Equal Opportunity Commission in South Australia, we concur that there is much more to do. For example, our formal complaints received last financial year, of them 26% related to either sexuality, gender or sexual harassment, and 20% of our inquiries are on this topic. And whilst we deal with these individual complaints, this data informs our education and training program, where we seek to educate and prevent discrimination in workplaces through training and education of employers, employees and service providers. And this is critical to changing attitudes and culture. So Professor Altman's work is very important to us at the Equal Opportunity Commission and to many of you, and I am very keen to hear his presentation tonight. We thank the Don Dunstan Foundation and Oxfam for inviting Professor Altman to present the Human Rights Oration tonight. So without further ado, please join me in the honour of welcoming the esteemed Professor Dennis Altman to address us. Thank you.
Dr. King, Chancellor, Ms. Gale and friends, it really is a great privilege to be here in Adelaide to deliver an oration that honours such a great Australian. South Australia has, as we like to say, often punched above its weight in helping create in Australia a more tolerant, diverse and culturally rich society. And in thinking about coming here, I was reminded of the fact that this state was the first to have both an Aboriginal and then a woman as governor, that is the home of the Adelaide Festival, and that has given Australia an extraordinary roll call of eminent artistic and political figures. Can I also say it's a great honour and opportunity to be speaking here with my old colleague, Justice Michael Kirby, who we will hear from at the end of the lecture. Michael and I first met in the crucible of student politics in the 1960s, and even then, as Michael likes to remind me, I was likely to be wearing a scruffy duffel coat while he was already dressed as befits a rising lawyer in suit and tie. When Michael and I were young men, Don Dunstan was already known as a remarkable figure, had first been Premier between 67 and 68, and then again for almost the entire period of the 1970s. And for my generation, he represented the possibilities of major social change in a country that we believed needed to be dragged towards a better and more tolerant future. And I think that the ongoing importance of the foundation is to remind people of the significance of probably the most innovative post-war premier in Australia's history. Dunstan represented a new generation of Labor leaders who helped lay the cornerstones for a more cosmopolitan, tolerant, and culturally adventurous society. And Don Dunstan was also a significant figure in the evolution towards the acceptance of sexual diversity. Indeed, the Dunstan Foundation has recently promoted this through their support for the work of Indy Wishart in fighting homophobic bullying in schools, and the work of the historian Dino Hodge, who's with us here tonight. I'm aware that Dino's recent research prompted the local newspaper to ask in rather large headlines whether funding research into, quote, Dunstan's private life is money well spent. I thought that was an odd question from the Murdoch Press, given how much money they spend investigating private lives. But the real point, and I will return to it, is that you cannot totally ignore the complex sexuality of Don Dunstan and how it affected his career if we want to fully understand the political history of South Australia and indeed of Australia. And a number of people have noted that at the time of Dunstan's death, there was a certain erasure of his homosexuality and his commitment to the cause, as Robert has pointed out, of homosexual law reform. One of Dunstan's last public acts was to hold an evening for the first gay and lesbian feast at the restaurant he ran with his then partner, Stephen Cheng. I think the best general discussion of Don Dunstan's sexuality comes from former Federal Minister Neil Blewett, also, of course, a South Australian, who has pointed to the dislike generated by his sexual ambiguity, highlighted by the sartorial flamboyance, unusual amongst politicians of his time. And indeed, Karen Goldsworthy, in her recent rather wonderful book on Adelaide, also points to the shock caused by Dunstan's famous appearance in pink shorts. As Blewett writes, much of the personal acalmony, vicious character assassinations, and gutter-level smear campaigns circulating through Adelaide during his years in power thrived on the questioning of his sexual identity. And I want to come back at the end of the lecture to say a little bit about the public-private distinction and how we might think about the complexities of sexual behaviour, identity and desires. But at this point, I want to recognise that it is important to understand that Dunstan came from an era when attitudes towards sexuality were very different to those that now exist, and that it is very difficult for us sometimes to recall the historical context in which certain choices were made by people entering public life. I think it is impossible for anyone, although some people have tried, to know how Don Dunstan, had he been born 30 years later, might have understood and managed his sexuality and public identity. Remember that Don Dunstan was born in 1926 and was elected to state parliament at the age of 27. Very, very young, and at a period when anti-homosexual hysteria, which sometimes overlapped with an exaggerated fear of communism, was the dominant view, and when the police forces of most states regularly entrapped and effectively blackmailed homosexual men. And we know that that is the case in this state. This is a period that Barry Humphreys dismissed in a pretty typical offhand comment by saying, "Poofters were happily confined to the small hermetic world of ballet and window dressing." I don't think that Barry Humphreys even thought lesbians worth mentioning. As Senator Hill has pointed out, 1972 was an extraordinary year in the evolution of gay rights in Australia, and in part, of course, because of events that happened here only, what, half a mile from where we're now sitting. When an Adelaide University lecturer, George Duncan, was drowned at a cruising spot on the Torrens River, most likely by police officers. That murder, which received considerable media coverage, was a crucial moment for hastening the beginnings of a serious push to decriminalise homosexual behaviour. Not since the 1830s, inquiry into the effects of transportation on convicted persons, wrote the historian Jill Rowe at the time, has there been such smouldering concern about homosexuality. 3 months after Duncan's drowning, possibly at the time that you, Senator, were helping draft the bill, I remember attending a large public meeting at this very university where Adelaide Gay Liberation was established. And there was a period in the 1970s when Adelaide was a really significant centre of gay activism in Australia. I said to Senator Hill when he sat down that I now could take a paragraph out of my prepared speech because he has not only outlined what happened, but he's in fact added to my knowledge of what happened. And of course the point is that by the end of 1972, because of the manoeuvres he referred to, in South Australia homosexual acts were, if not exactly legal, not exactly illegal either. It wasn't until 1975, after several years of cross-party discussion, that South Australia became the first Australian jurisdiction which actually decriminalised homosexual behaviour. And I actually was reminded when the Chancellor was speaking of that other period in Australian history when a bipartisan effort prevented the worst prejudices and biases and led to extremely important public policy decisions, and that is the early years of the AIDS epidemic, when, again, the cooperation of some very significant Liberal senators with the then Labor government made it possible for Australia to take up a number of very far-sighted policies that helped prevent a massive spread of the epidemic. Now, at the time that Duncan was drowned and that parliamentarians such as Murray Hill, Peter Duncan, who became Attorney General, and Don Dunstan himself were leading moves for decriminalisation, homosexuality was generally regarded as an illness, a perversion, or at best a deviance. These attitudes now seem remarkably outdated, although research shows us that a significant minority of Australians, more likely to be male and less well educated, still share them. But 4 decades later, public debates around homosexuality are very different. States and territories have abolished virtually all criminal sanctions against homosexual behaviour and included discrimination, as we just heard, on the grounds of sexuality within the ambit of anti-discrimination legislation. And I might just actually interpose a personal account of what this really means. My partner has just been very, very ill. What struck me in dealing with people at St Vincent's Hospital in Melbourne was that at no point did anyone question that I was his next of kin. That would have been inconceivable probably even 20 years ago. And I can see many people nodding their heads and can understand just how important and significant for both of us that cultural shift was. Indeed, I recently read a comment on Facebook. I will admit to being on Facebook, so those of you who are so inclined can now take the opportunity to befriend me, preferably not during the course of the lecture, though, where a young man wrote, "I think the people who have paved the way for me as a gay man, to have never had to struggle with my sexuality, I think we should be glad to be just a piece of the puzzle that makes up society. I don't think of myself as a different entity from the world. We are just people who love the same sex. Let's not focus on our differences, but celebrate we are basically all the same. The days we had to fight are over. Celebrate being included, not focusing on our differences." And I think that while those comments are somewhat naive, they do also point to a very major cultural shift in this country. And I want to ask two questions tonight. Why have there been such shifts? Why have Australian attitudes changed dramatically? What does it tell us about Australia? And second, why are such changes demonstrably not occurring in many other parts of the world? I think that the real shifts are a reflection of how Australia itself has changed and of the way in which new concepts of human rights have replaced older concepts of morality that were based on particular sorts of religious teachings, as well as the agency of the gay and lesbian movement, whose 40th anniversary we're effectively celebrating at the moment. The 1970s saw the birth and the re-energising of a set of social movements whose impact is still felt today. And of course, the women's and the environmental movement, and to some extent the Aboriginal movement, are all part of that story. The first significant gay and lesbian organisation in Australia actually dates back to 1970, when John Weir and Chris Pohl founded the Campaign Against Moral Persecution in Sydney, which was the first major open homosexual rights group in the country. And the acronym CAMP, of course, picked up a word that ironically was beginning to disappear from the language and would very soon be replaced by the American import gay and then gay and lesbian, and increasingly added, we had to add other initials. So we now talk about the gay, lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersexual, and you can continue. And a prize will be given at the end of the evening to anyone who comes up with the longest acronym. But quickly, there was a growth of the movement, and a small but energetic group of people started publicly challenging the dominant ways in which homosexuality was then understood. Most importantly, I think, we as a country have come to recognise that sexual and gender diversity is another aspect of multiculturalism. Many years ago, I speculated that most Australians would be less threatened by a lesbian bar opening on their street than a mosque. And I think that, and while I don't support this view, I think unfortunately that is probably truer today than when I first said it. Indeed, the changes that leaders like Dunstan fought for in his opposition to the White Australia policy is clearly connected to a larger acceptance of diversity in general, to the idea that a diverse society is a richer society, that acceptance of human variation and human diversity allows for all sorts of possibilities. And, of course, the huge changes in how we think of gender, in how we think of what is acceptable behaviour for women and men, has in turn opened up possibilities to imagine lives that go well beyond the stereotypes of the heterosexual nuclear family. And I regret that I'm old enough, but so I'm pleased to say are many of you in this audience, to remember the shock when we first saw the first woman newsreader on television, the first woman teller in a bank, or you were sitting on a plane and suddenly the pilot's voice was a woman's voice. All those changes represent, to me, huge shifts in how we think about ourselves as a nation, and that in turn has opened up space to allow for us to recognise diversity in very different ways to those that were common until the 1970s. It's also, I think, been impossible to retain the belief for most people that homosexuality is a sin. The term itself has resonance for fewer and fewer people. Until recently, it was assumed by most that sexual mores should be governed by religious absolutes. Although I must say I've never understood why religious leaders who are so upset by consensual pleasure seem far less concerned about widespread human suffering. But it seems to me that even now in Australia, there are some very real questions to be asked about the way in which prejudiced and ignorant attitudes towards sexuality are conveyed, particularly through religious-based schools, which still enjoy immunity in most states from official anti-discrimination provisions. And I'll have to ask the experts later if that is also the case in this state, but certainly is in my own state. But leaving aside the question of religious leaders, there is, I think, a way in which over the last few decades there has been a major change in our understanding of human rights to include the right to sexual freedom and expression. 1991, Amnesty International adopted a policy that affirmed that to persecute or discriminate against people on the basis of sexuality is a violation of their basic human rights. In 1996, post-apartheid South Africa became the first country to protect sexual orientation in its Bill of Rights. And over the past decade, the language of sexual rights and citizenship has been adopted in a number of arenas, including important discourse around health and international development. And there have been some surprising achievements in countries such as Nepal, where a very small but effective movement has managed to achieve considerable shifts in official attitudes and legislation. In 2006, a meeting of the International Commission of Jurists and others drafted the Yogyakarta Principles on the application of international human rights law in relation to sexual orientation and gender identity, which is the most important attempt yet to establish universal norms around the decriminalisation of same-sex acts between consenting adults. It's worth remembering that Australia, played an important role in the development of international protection for sexual rights, largely due to the bravery of two young Tasmanian activists, Rodney Croom and Nick Toonan. As I'm sure most of you know, Tasmania was the last state to hold out against decriminalising homosexual behaviour. And I hasten to say, as someone who grew up in Tasmania, this is not because Tasmania is mean, nasty and different. It's because they had a rigged upper house, something I think you in South Australian politics know something about. But after years of political activism and the upper house constantly blocking attempts to change that law, a small group of activists decided to appeal to the United Nations Human Rights Committee, a possibility that was open to them because the Federal Labor Government had signed a protocol which allowed its citizens to follow this route once all domestic avenues had been exhausted. Nick Toonan eventually became the victorious plaintiff in what was a groundbreaking case, and one that continues to be a benchmark in international attempts to overturn laws prohibiting consensual homosexual activity. And in 1994, in the case of Toonan versus Australia, the Human Rights Committee ruled that the reference to sex in the ICCPR should be taken to include sexual orientation. Now, that is not a precedent that has been followed consistently, but it allowed the federal government to invoke its external affairs power to pressure the Tasmanian government to change the law. It was a long and complicated process. It's interesting, another three-year process of to and froing between the federal and state authorities, and eventually the Tasmanian parliament decriminalised homosexual behaviour and ironically has now become, in a sense, the state in the vanguard of pushing for gay and lesbian rights, with the state premier Lara Giddings introducing legislation this year to recognise same-sex marriage. By and large, I'd argue there have been huge steps over the last 40 years. But I'd also argue this does not mean there are not real areas of discrimination and prejudice, and areas where we have to pay particular attention, often prejudice that's sanctified in the name of religion or exists within communities who come from countries where any discussion of homosexuality remains unacceptable. Attacking people for their sexuality, indeed bashing violently people for their sexuality, still remains acceptable in a way that it is largely not for any other group. And only a few weeks ago, I happened to overhear a young man telling a friend that his parents were told either they throw him out of the house or they no longer come to church. Those attitudes still live in our society. And the official position of the Catholic Church, along with many other of our institutionalised religious bodies, and I only single out the Catholic Church because it has such a large nominal membership in Australia, is that homosexual acts are acts of great depravity that are intrinsically disordered and contrary to the natural law. Now, the clash between the religious and the secular view of society is currently being played out in Australia in an apparently endless debate about same-sex marriage, which I have to say fascinates very many more people than any sensible assessment of what's at stake seems to me to explain. I, as you may have guessed, remain somewhat sceptical about the importance of marriage, having an old-fashioned feminist view that is rather suspicious of seeking the sanction of the state or the church for our personal relationships. And it's important to note that, unlike the United States, in this country legislation grants de facto homosexual couples almost all the rights of married couples. So the arguments that we hear from the United States do not necessarily apply in the same way in this country. But I also recognise that for very many homosexuals, particularly for many younger lesbians and gay men, they see marriage equality as absolutely critical and crucial as leading us to full acceptance of sexual diversity. And as I've said, and I've actually said this to the two of the members of Parliament who introduced the bills that have so far failed federally, I am not prepared to end up on the same side of Cardinal Pell against Senator Penny Wong. There is, I think, an irony. Our political leaders, it appears, hold more conservative views than the population at large. And in the short run, it is very unlikely that this or the next parliament will change the Marriage Act. I think that's true. I'd be interested to know what the Chancellor thinks, even if the Liberals were to allow a conscience vote amongst their membership. I do rather wish that the current Conservative parties would listen to the British Prime Minister David Cameron, who said that he supports gay marriage precisely because he is a Conservative. Okay, if, however, in this country and in other Western countries, there has been, and I think there has been, huge progress towards the acceptance of sexual diversity, this is certainly not a universal picture. Indeed, there appears to be a growing polarisation around sexual rights as Western countries push for greater acceptance, while many African and Islamic and other governments are responding by what the American anthropologist Tom Berlstorff has termed political homophobia. And what Tom means by that is a certain sort of heterosexual masculinity, often reinforced by religious precepts, but aimed at upholding and enforcing a particular form of national identity and resistance to what is claimed is the decadence of Western society. You can hear that in a recent interview, for example, with the new president of Egypt, Mohamed Morsi, who studied in the US and has publicly talked about his admiration for American technical savvy and his dislike for its sexual permissiveness. And you might think, or our media likes to tell us, that these views are predominant in Islamic countries, but they're also widely found in parts of the world influenced by Christianity, whether it's the Russian Orthodox Church or a variety of Protestant evangelical churches in much of Africa, the Caribbean, and Papua New Guinea. And indeed, one of the most obvious forms of increasing discrimination and hatred came in 2009 in Uganda, when legislation was introduced that would have mandated a death sentence for repeated acts of sodomy. Under considerable international pressure, that move was withdrawn. But the following year, a prominent gay activist, David Kato, was killed. In fact, he was murdered shortly after he won a lawsuit against a local magazine which published his name and photograph and a call for him to be executed. And even at his funeral, a Christian preacher railed against the gays and lesbians who were present before activists ran to the pulpit and grabbed the microphone away. In Nigeria, where homosexual sex is already illegal, there are frequent calls for tougher legal restrictions. And in much of the Middle East, the punishment for homosexual behaviour remains draconian. Large numbers of people are actually killed with impunity because it is assumed that they are homosexual. In South Africa, despite the provisions of the South African Constitution that I referred to earlier, a particularly nasty phenomenon known as corrective rape is common, where women perceived as lesbian are seen as fair game for rape because it will somehow convert them to an appropriate model of what a woman should be. And I raise these issues partly because I don't think we in this country think nearly often enough about the international context of sexual rights, but also, of course, because this oration is in part sponsored by Oxfam. I sat on the board of Oxfam for 4 years, 2006 to 2010, and I retain a very close connection to Oxfam. I'm deeply disappointed that it turns out the outgoing CEO of Oxfam is in Adelaide tonight, but at a different function. Had Andrew and I known, I'm sure we would have found a way of merging our two events. But I was struck then by a deep concern in the development world for policies that are relevant to gender equality and an almost total disinterest in how they might relate to sexuality. Now, it's of course true that economic inequality between women and men is one of the most basic dimensions of poverty. Although it is also important to point out that even in many developing countries, upper-class women are better off on almost all criteria than many men. It's also important to point out that gender is not simply a binary division between women and men. We know that gender is a complex continuum of biological and emotional factors, and that there are people who struggle with the gulf they perceive between their assumed gender and how they feel about themselves. Some societies, in fact, have long recognised the idea of a third sex. In our region, if you think about the Ketui in Thailand or the Waria in Indonesia, they are actually variants of an acceptance that some men, that is men defined biologically, will in fact identify as women. And there has in fact been work done on the particular problems that face transgendered people in humanitarian crises. I've never heard this discussed at all in the development sector in Australia, even though I have actually been quite involved in that sector. I do remember pointing out when the anti-homosexual bills were being discussed in Uganda that improving the livelihoods for women would not be of great help if those women faced rape, beating or murder because they were presumed to be lesbian. Now, there are of course some exceptions. Oxfam Ireland, for example, has run some innovative programs. Oxfam Australia has supported some innovative programs in KwaZulu-Natal. But, and I I regret there are not more people from Oxfam here, but I made this point to the chair of the Oxfam board yesterday at lunch, so I feel it's okay to say it here. I find it a matter of deep regret that Oxfam in general is more timid in expressing its concern for sexual rights than is either the Secretary of State Hillary Clinton or Conservative Prime Minister David Cameron. How we in a country like Australia address discrimination and persecution in countries that defend them in the name of cultural and religious rights is extremely difficult. I recognise that when Hillary Clinton or David Cameron make statements, there is a great danger that this can cause a backlash. This actually can assist the most reactionary forces in the countries under attack to mobilise around anti-imperialist slogans. And support for LGBT rights from US embassies, and I've seen flyers which use American-style rainbow flags, are quite understandably going to be seen as crude attempts to impose a particular set of moral values on other people. But in the end, I stand with such eminent South Africans as Archbishop Desmond Tutu and Justice Edwin Cameron, who would insist that basic rights cannot be trumped by appeals to culture, tradition, and religion. To persecute, torture, and rape on the basis of perceived sexual or gender dissidents is just straightforwardly a crime against humanity, and it is one about which we hear very little from our political leaders. When the Commonwealth heads of government met in Perth last year, a majority of the leaders there were unwilling to support arguments put forward by the Eminent Persons Committee, of which Michael Kirby was a member, that consideration of both public health and human rights demanded an end to the criminalisation of private adult sexual acts across the Commonwealth. And this remains a real issue in international discourse. And it's an issue that I think we need to find ways. We have a government that keeps on boasting that we are an influential middle power, that we stand between our region of the world, and most of the countries in our region of the world retain those laws and are deeply prejudiced and often silent around abuses against people because of their sexuality. This, I think, is a real challenge for us in the forthcoming Asian century, and one on which we desperately need an intelligent and informed debate. So let me move then to a conclusion. I may suggest, going back to where I began when I said we need to think a little bit about Don Dunstan as a person, about the role of his own complex and ambivalent sexual life. Sexuality, it seems to me, is both public and private. The specific pleasures and practices of an individual are rarely relevant to those other than his or her partners. They should be left to novelists and filmmakers. They certainly should not be left to the Murdoch Press. But how we understand and imagine our sexual identities, to whom we're attracted, whether we act on or repress these desires, is an integral part of who we all are. And inevitably it will impact upon how we behave in the world, and therefore there are legitimate questions for public debate that we need address. It's become increasingly common, and I've already made this point, to speak of LGBT people, that is lesbian, gay, bisexual, transgender, etc., as if we are a self-evident minority who should be recognised as such. This is the view of sexuality that's expressed in popular shows like the now-defunct Gay Eye for the Straight Guy, which of course never allowed for the possibility that one of those dorky straight men might be attracted to one of those really attractive gay men. That would have totally undone the premise of the program, and yet everything we know about human behaviour suggests is quite likely. I think that what Don Dunstan's life, with its complex and deep relationships with both women and men, reminds us is that we can have more radical ways of understanding sexuality and that we all benefit from that sort of analysis. None of us can be identified solely in terms of one part of our identity. In fact, I can remember being in Adelaide and getting very, very angry with one of your local bookshops because one of my books had been placed in the gay section. I said, but it's actually not meant to be a gay book. You know, allow me to write about other things. So identity is both terribly important and it can also be an imprisonment. And those of us who belong to identified minorities have to constantly find ways of negotiating that space. But at the same time, I don't think we can pretend that sexual desires, identities and behaviours are irrelevant to who we are and how we act in the broader world. And I thank the Dunstan Foundation for inviting me to give this lecture. I think actually it was probably very brave of the foundation to do this, but then maybe word hadn't spread from Melbourne enough. And I very much hope that the foundation will find ways of incorporating, continuing to work with those people who are working around some of the issues of sexual rights, not only in South Australia, not only in Australia, but also internationally.
Beautiful. Yes. Thank you for an amazing oration, wide-ranging from the personal, the political, to the international. I'm sure that it opens up many topics for questions. So what we had in mind now was that there would be, you know, 10 minutes or so of questions before we have the vote of thanks. So there are two roving mics. Olivia's got one and the other one's here. So if people could raise their hands to indicate that they'd like to ask a question. Thank you. I see this gentleman here. Can I remind you that, you know, in fairness to everyone, if you could keep your question succinct to the point, it'll give our speaker time to respond.
Professor Altman, on my way here, I spoke to a young man. He produces the new gay and lesbian program at Radio Adelaide. Where are you going? I said, I'm going to hear Dennis Altman talk on 40 years of... He said, oh yeah, I think I got an invitation to that. And a large number of Adelaide's more active gay and lesbian community are down at the town hall, evidently, celebrating the Feast Festival. How do we communicate to 18, 19, 20-year-old gay people that they are part of this story? You quoted a naive comment earlier, but what are the techniques you suggest we should use?
I'm quite happy to take... if it would help, I can take all the questions... I could answer all the questions in one go.
Okay.
I'm taking notes. It gives a little more time to ask questions. And often questions repeat.
And then it'll be a complex response. Okay, there's a gentleman here.
I'm Budi from Flinders University. I'm glad that you mentioned the third sex. You mentioned about the Katoi in Thailand and Waria in Indonesia. I'm from Indonesia. My question is very simple. Do you think it would be possible to have third sex in this fluid Australian contemporary society? That's all.
Not many words, but complex idea. Thank you. And there was a hand over here. Yeah.
Anthony Longwa, also from Flinders University, as it happens. You mentioned the Asian Century white paper and the discussion, your points about engaging more with our region. I wondered if you had any comments about the new ASEAN Intergovernmental Commission on Human Rights and the fact that they're drafting a human rights bill at the moment, which is due to be presented, as you probably know, to the ASEAN meeting in November, and the great concern about that bill that it may not meet international best practice standards, and particularly concerns around the rights of women and clauses about public morality, which could quite obviously be used in the ways that you spoke about with concern. Thank you.
Professor Altman's nodding his head. He's got that one, yes. Perhaps we should make this, yes, we'd like to hear from you. This is the last one for this batch. Ask you to respond, and then there could be some follow-ups. Yeah.
I'm Georgia Heath. I'm from the Office for Women. I noticed in your presentation you seem to have to talk a few times about a linkage between the feminist movement and gay liberation. And I'm wondering if you think that that's a relationship that is needing to continue into the future, and if so, what you think that relationship might be.
Thanks.
Okay, well, I think the questions fall into two groups, I think. I'll deal first with the domestic ones. Look, I can understand perfectly if someone had said to me, do you want to go to a party to celebrate Feast or sit in a lecture hall and listen to Dennis, I would go and celebrate Feast, okay? There's nothing terrible about that. I think what is happening, and I see this among much younger people, is a real interest in history, in the history of sexuality. I think there are real challenges for our, and I have a chancellor, oh no, I don't have a chancellor anymore, but I have a vice chancellor in the room, and many people from universities in the room. I think this is a real challenge for universities. I think that I think that we need to be thinking about how untold histories and stories are taught not in segregated small courses with those names, which always bother me, but actually to first-year students who are going to go on and be doctors and lawyers and psychologists and nurses. And that to me is enormously important. So I think that that to me is how I would deal with the question of people need to, not only homosexuals, everybody needs to understand the complex ways in which attitudes and regulation of sexuality are historically determined and how they change. And as part of that story, one would, of course, talk about the very interesting and complicated relationship between feminism and the gay movement. And when we say gay movement, in this case, we usually mean the gay male movement. But remember, when gay was first termed as a word, it did actually mean women and men. And then, of course, one has to start talking about the fact that there are many varieties of feminism and that at various points in time, some feminists have been strong allies with many gay men. Others have been bitterly opposed to what they see as sexual permissiveness, and in fact use language that's not all that different to the language that is used by the Russian Orthodox Church. So I think that my answer to both of the domestic questions really does come back to the fact that we do a pretty bad job still in our educational institutions. The other questions which relate to the international. Look, I think that the traditional concept of the third sex is actually a product of certain sorts of societies that modernization and globalization make more and more difficult. And of course, in both Thailand and Indonesia, there is some tension between those people who say, we are lesbians, we are gay, on the one hand, and those people who say, no, we are third sex. And third sex, as it's understood, I mean, it would take me an hour because there's also a Western tradition of talking about being third sex going back to 19th century Germany. And it gets us into terribly complicated discussions about what is transgender, what is the relationship between people's sense of their own bodies and the way other people see their bodies and how they feel themselves. But no, I don't think that, I mean, my sense is that, and I'll take Thailand, which I know best, that those tensions are very real. And the answers will be worked out in rather different ways depending on the social and cultural context. I think the point about ASEAN is very, very interesting. Very recently, a Filipino ambassador at the United Nations Human Rights Commission made the rather surprising statement that the Philippines would be prepared to take leadership in the region on gay and lesbian rights. I say rather surprising, and I know this from my friend, Filipino friends who were there. They were stunned. They didn't expect their minister to say this. And I don't think anybody quite knows where it came from and whether it means anything. And I mean, you are pointing, obviously, to a real problem, that ASEAN contains a range of countries, some of which will be very repressive in their attitudes to a whole slew of human rights issues, not just those around gender and sexuality. And, you know, I am not, interested to see what Michael says, but I'm not overly optimistic that we should assume things will easily get better. There was recently a vote in one of the UN, was it in the UN Human Rights Committee, in which the Russians put forward an amendment that basically said, in effect, defended cultural rights as against universality. I mean, that's simplifying it enormously. And some countries that have previously been in favour of recognising sexual rights voted with the Russians. So I think that we are going to go through a long period of what I've called polarisation around these issues, and I don't have easy answers. But I think you're pointing to something that is, I think, we need to have a real debate about. If we are going to engage more with the countries of our region, which is something I highly applaud, I really wish that our politicians would stop putting it in terms of trade and investment and sometimes recognise that human rights are actually more important than yet another Chinese firm buying an iron ore mine.
Are there other people who'd like to put up some questions?
From what you've said, and what I've always thought, is that the great changes in attitude in the last 40 years in this country is surely due to the decline of religion. I'd have thought there was a strong correlation between general attitudes to religion and attitudes towards gay people.
Excellent. Thanks, Anne. Yeah.
You raised the point with regards to Don Dunstan that partly what he's attacked for isn't just his sexuality but the ambivalence thereof, and that there's an attitude towards kind of certainty of recognised identity, and I wanted you to talk a bit more about that in both the like national and international context, if you could.
Thank you. Would anyone else? This is probably the last call for questions by the time. Okay.
I'm going to be very restrained as someone who is a deep secularist and deeply suspicious of all organised religion. I think that there is surprising acceptance of homosexuality among many people who are quite strongly religious. I think, unfortunately, it seems very rarely to reach the upper echelons of religious institutions. And I think there's an interesting problem there that's worth thinking about. But I would agree entirely that, you see, I'm not sure that we are becoming a more secular society. I am deeply troubled by the fact that we say we're becoming a more secular society at a time in which we have introduced a school chaplains program, which is farmed out to groups of quite fundamentalist evangelical groups. And I actually have checked this out, and in each state it's different people who've got the contracts, but this worries me. So I think that one has to be very careful in both in assuming that because people are religious they will hold certain attitudes. I think that's true. But also I think we have to be equally cautious in saying Australia is becoming more secular. There is something very ironic about our atheist Prime Minister being so prepared to defend a growing role for religious institutions in the education system. On the attacks on Don Dunstan, look, this is difficult for me to say much because I know there are many people in this room who know so much more about Don Dunstan and that period than I do. I think that Don Dunstan clearly unsettled people during his time in office who often didn't quite know what it was about him that unsettled them. That there was something about his persona that deeply troubled a lot of people, and they couldn't quite put their finger on it. There was, of course, a decade of gossip, of innuendo, of suggestions. The reason I brought up the pink shorts episode is because, as I say, Karen Goldsworthy, in her book on Adelaide, makes it actually the heading of her chapter on Dunstan. It's perhaps unfortunate, I think, but she does. And that at the time, as I vaguely recall, did represent to people such an infringement of propriety that they read all sorts of other things into it. And I think it's still true that deviation from sexual and gender norms unsettles people. But I also think, and this is a point I didn't have time to make, that there are huge changes going on in our popular culture. And if you look at a program like Glee, and I know many people in this room probably won't admit you watch Glee, but I happily will admit that I watch Glee. I like Glee. But look at a program like Glee or Modern Family or Tara or 6 Feet Under. In fact, interestingly, over the last 10 years, the most interesting discussion of sex and gender is coming from HBO television in the United States. And that is reaching young people in ways that people of my generation had no counterpart to. And so if I'm going to be optimistic, that makes me optimistic, and I will end up on an optimistic note even about the developing world, and that is going to Durban Airport and seeing huge billboards for Sex and the City. Now, I think Sex and the City is a crappy show, but I think that the way in which Sex and the City suggested different ways of thinking about gender and sexuality in a conservative society is actually quite important. And maybe at that point I should stop and...
Now my pleasure to call on Honourable Michael Kirby to propose our vote of thanks.
Dennis said that we would probably be happier at the feast party than here tonight, but I think all of us will agree that we've had a real feast from Dennis and that we were in the right place. Vice Chancellor, representatives and professors of Flinders University, Commissioner, and fellow citizens, I want to give a threefold thanks. First of all, I want to thank Dennis. And I want to thank him not just for his terrific lecture tonight, but for really a lifelong service of leadership. I knew Dennis back, I think it was either 1963 or 64. I was the president of the Students' Representative Council of the University of Sydney. And he came up from the University of Tasmania to a meeting of the National Union of Australian University Students at Monash University, which was then a great paddock with just one big building in the middle of nowhere. I remember thinking at the time he was a very troublesome person. He was a very troublesome student politician. He wasn't inclined to just go on and talk about the things we wanted to talk about, which was, is it right for university students to be concerned about sporting links with South Africa? He wanted to talk about the wider issues of the world, and every now and again he would drop things rather elliptically at that time, which entered into my very inner being, which was at that time very, very silent, very, very quiet, very, very frightened. And Dennis really is the first. I mean, there weren't many who were before Dennis, and he was noisy, and he was brave, and he was intellectual, he was strong, he was a leader, and he made it easier for me later on. It is true that we stand on the shoulders of our predecessors, and I stand proudly on Dennis's shoulders for his intellectual leadership, his empiricism, his scholarship, and we've seen a wonderful example of that tonight. He's been at this all those years since 1963-65. He's been at this. His book in 72, just think of that. I want to thank him, and I want to thank him publicly. His part in Australian history is sure, because he took a really important leadership position on this issue. I also want to thank the Chancellor, though he's had to leave. I think we were very fortunate tonight to have that little vignette, and we must encourage him to write that down, because that's something that none of us really knew before tonight. It redounds to his father's credit, Murray Hill, but it also redounds to his credit as a young lawyer to be interested enough and not to be rushing off to a party, but to be sitting down with another colleague in Crown Law doing the first bill, which became the first step in the legislative measures that led to the changes that led to the law in South Australia, the first in the country. So I thank the Chancellor for that, and I'd be glad if the Vice-Chancellor would say we were all appreciative of what he said, and we were all admiring of his father and of him. Thirdly, I want to thank Don Dunstan. Now, I knew Don Dunstan. I first met him when he came, as I was reminded the other day, with Mike Rann. Mike Rann was his press officer. I was the Deputy Chancellor of the University of Newcastle. He came up to deliver the Newcastle address in the Great Hall of the University of Newcastle. My job was to meet him at Williamtown Airport and accompany him and his press officer, whose name I just heard was Mike, and who I thought was an extremely handsome young man. Don Dunstan was always surrounded by very handsome young men. Mike Rann apparently now says he had no idea. Well, I think that that is something where memory has faded with the passing of the years, because Don Dunstan was a person who had a beautiful voice. He was a really beautiful person. He was an actor. He was a consummate actor. But he also had substance. And he was a leader in Australia. And his leadership was in many fields. I was looking as I sat there at the programmatic charter of the Don Dunstan Foundation. And it really does add strength to the parting comments of Dennis Altman at the end. To airbrush out of Don Dunstan's contribution, his contribution to sexuality law reform in Australia, is to deprive him and his contribution to our country of a really important aspect of what he did. Now, as Dino Hodges mentioned in a chapter to a recent collection of papers out there, I said in a Hawke lecture, I said Don Dunstan was the first politician who started the process of accommodating Australia to a change in the laws relating to homosexuals. As I look back on it, I really was saying that without a lot of deep thought and a lot of careful research, but as Dino's made clear in his chapter, accidentally I think I was right, because it was Don Dunstan who wrote that first bill in 1965, I think, at about the time Dennis and I were meeting each other. And it was Don Dunstan, therefore, who really became the father of the legislative moves. And they took Murray Hill's legislation, and they took Peter Duncan's legislation, but his hand was behind the efforts to get the legislation through. It's probably because of that ambivalence that upset and intrigued and fascinated and hurt some people, that he was rather cautious. This wasn't the only subject on which he was cautious. I recently had the honour to give, for Flinders, the Elliot Johnston lecture. And in that, it was revealed, when I did the research on that, that it was Don Dunstan and his government that corrected the wrong of depriving Elliot Johnston of his position as Silk. But when the proposal was put up to the Cabinet that Elliot Johnston be appointed to the Supreme Court of South Australia, as would have been a worthy and proper thing to do to a person of his experience, suddenly the alarm bells went off. There was something about Don Dunstan's establishment background and view that led him to balk, and he would not approve it. And it took the Bannon government later to appoint Elliot Johnston. So there were streams of great conservatism in Don Dunstan, and they are revealed, I think, in the fact that he wouldn't put his hand on the legislation, but he was behind the scenes, and he took the first step with the bill, and therefore, accidentally, I was right in expressing thanks. So I thank him, but something's got to be done in the Dunstan Foundation. You could do it with a slight, very small change, celebration of cultural, ethnic, sexuality and other diversity, because it's not just cultural and ethnic. Or you could add something to human rights, but certainly somewhere there, you know, we're not in the country of Leventi Beria. We don't airbrush people out, and we don't airbrush out important aspects of people's contribution. And what's that? Well, that itself may be a clue as to what I'm trying to say. He doesn't control us, and he doesn't control history. And I would urge upon the foundation that they give some thought to this. I want to thank Dennis for giving us, as he usually does, an international dimension, and giving us the dimension of the work within the Commonwealth. Now, I was on the Eminent Persons Group, and I faced that question Dennis raised. How do you get this group, which is chaired by Tun Abdullah Badawi, a very senior Islamic politician, former Prime Minister of Malaysia, and how do you get a representative from Uganda? How do you get Asma Jahangir, a human rights lawyer, Islamic, from Pakistan? How do you get them to sign on to the need to get rid of the sexuality laws in the Commonwealth of Nations? 41 of 54 countries still have those criminal laws. In every way, as Dennis has made it clear, and I certainly agree, that is a much more important issue than marriage equality, because relationships can go on. My relationship of 43 years with Johan has gone on perfectly well, thank you very much, without the sanctification and blessing of marriage, and it'll go, keep going on. I support gay marriage, I support equality, but what is really urgent are those terrible laws that oppress people and provide the basis of stigmatisation and hatred against people in so many countries that literally are matters of life and death. And that's why what we did in the group to get unanimity, we dressed it up in the raiments of HIV/AIDS. HIV is twice as high in Commonwealth countries as it is in non-Commonwealth countries. And the Commonwealth countries are the biggest offenders in the world in criminalisation of same-sex activity. And the links, if you can look at the graphs which were provided to us by the United Nations, of the levels in the Caribbean, in the non-Commonwealth countries, of HIV, quite low. Levels in Commonwealth countries, very high. And though there will no doubt be arguments about the data, the Eminent Persons Group recommended, and I agree with Dennis, getting it actually done on the ground is going to be a really big challenge. And I hope that in our new role as the member of the Security Council, we will find ways in the United Nations to be brave and strong as a country. And I hope the Chancellor, with his unrivaled knowledge of the United Nations, will lend his strength to continuing the work that his father began to make Australia a strong voice. Ban Ki-moon, astonishingly, is a very strong voice on this issue. He is a very strong voice on this issue. And he says there are no exceptions for religious or cultural reasons. This is a matter of universal human rights, which is at the core of the United Nations, and he will continue to make that point. And he's just got another term as Secretary General. So we have to make sure that that our representative at the Security Council does all this. The final thing I'd like to say, and I'm sure I speak for everyone in this room, Dennis mentioned the illness of his partner. Now, all of us who have lovers, partners, spouses, family, parents, and others who are close to us and dear to us know how important that is when somebody's very ill. And I would like to say our respects as citizens of Australia to Anthony and to Dennis, and I would like to convey our thanks to Anthony for his part in the struggle that Dennis has continued to offer on behalf of vulnerable people, not only in Australia, not only in South Australia, but all around the world. So we've had a feast. Thank you all very much, and thank you, Dennis Altman.